Now, the former Labour MP and Strictly Come Dancing star Ed Balls is taking a trip through America's Deep South to meet Trump's most avid supporters. All this for a new programme on BBC Two. It's called Travels in Trump Land with Ed Balls, who's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. So you're a TV presenter now. You're jumping on our patch.
I know. Can you believe it? I'm a chairman of a football club. I'm a fellow at Harvard. I'm doing TV presenting, all sorts of different things. It's quite a distance away from being a politician in the cabinet, but there we are.
How scary was it when you lost the gig that you know how to do and you've got to reinvent yourself? Or was it exhilarating?
I think after 5 years in opposition, when it was clear that the Conservatives had a majority, the prospect of more years in opposition, you know, was a bit frustrating. So it was a new start for me. It was the opportunity to do different things. I didn't know what. If you'd said to me that night that I would be on Strictly Come Dancing or doing a programme about Donald Trump for the BBC, I wouldn't have believed you. But then if you'd told me Jeremy Corbyn would be leader of the Labour Party in a few months, I wouldn't have believed that either. So, you know, it was. There's always uncertainty in the world, and I figure you've got to embrace new things and have a go and try and enjoy it.
I spoke to Lembit Opik when he lost his income from politics, basically. And he went from to a point where he could barely pay the bills, and he was quite frank about that. What was the reality like for you? Did you worry about those practical necessities of you've got to earn a living, or were you confident?
Of course you worry, because we have mortgages and got to make things add up. And the nature of being a politician was that we didn't have loads of savings in the bank. And so you just have to wait and see what came along. And I do lots of things, have done from the beginning, like, you know, chairing Norwich City Football Club. That's an unpaid job. I am chairman of the foundation building the memorial for the Holocaust next to Parliament. That's unpaid. So you get lots of offers to do things which where there's no payment. But, of course, you've got to pay the bills. So I didn't know how it was going to be for quite a few months. But then things started to come in. And as you know, the nature of doing TV programmes for the BBC is that you know, it's not like going to do it for Netflix or a Hollywood studio. But it's fine, and I'm making it work. And
do you mean they're not paying you enough, Mr. Balls?
I'm certainly not saying that. I'm just saying that. It's not
I think you just hinted at it.
I'm saying it's not made me a millionaire.
Okay, so why are you doing it?
I'm doing it because it's always good to try new things, and because I wanted to understand what was going on in America. And I guess I have a pretty unique perspective, because there's this guy, Donald Trump, who was in reality TV for years. He was the head of the American Apprentice program. And then suddenly he became the president of the United States. And I'm somebody who went the other way. So I was a politician for years and years. And then I then went and suddenly went into reality TV. So I thought, is there something about the fact we went in different directions which could help me to understand what's been going on? And then the other thing is that I was the MP for a marginal seat for lots of years. You learn that if as a politician you tell people you're wrong, I'll tell you why, they don't hear what you say, so you've got to go and listen. And I think there's lots of people who don't understand how could people vote for Donald Trump. Yeah. I think from a British perspective, he's wild, he's misogynist, he's out of control, he's macho. But millions of Americans voted for him. So I came up with the idea with Expectation and the BBC that we would go not to Washington and talk to politicians, but go and spend a long time living with Trump voters and try and get under the skin of what's happening in America.
I don't mind saying this. I was personally shocked myself. I went out and did a similar thing for Five Live, BBC Radio Five Live. And the passion with which the supporters of Trump speak about him and the conviction that they have that he is an honest man speaking the truth to power, yeah, when, of course, the reality is he has the power. He is the power. But they see him speaking truth to power. And that is either real, Ed, not for me to say, yeah, or it's very clever marketing by President Trump.
Well, look, there's no doubt the guy is very clever at marketing and communication. But I think the interesting thing about the program we've made is that if you're looking for people to be deluded or extreme, that's not what we find. The third episode on Sunday night, BBC Two, 9 o'clock, is the third episode we go to Mar-a-Lago, which is his big club down in Florida. I go with a group of very, very wealthy supporters called the Trumpets, 800 people at a one-year on celebration. They are the people you've just described. They are cheerleaders. They are total supporters. He can do no wrong. I sit round a table with eight of them and ask them about the terrible things he said about women. If you remember the tape, you know, where he talked about grabbing women,
yeah,
and they're sort of dismissing it. Boys will be boys. He's a family man.
Locker room talk, he described it,
but,
didn't he?
See, they don't want to hear any criticism. But then I go to meet some factory workers up in Georgia, and I think these people are much more typical of the people I've been seeing all through this program. They're actually really head screwed on, feet on the ground. They say he tweets too much. He's a bit wild. They're worried the White House is a bit chaotic. They don't like what he says about women. They totally can understand the dangers when he plays the race card, which he does sometimes, in my view. But what they say is that he's offering a different way, a change. And they're so disillusioned with what's happened in Washington from Democrat and Republican presidents. They think, well, you know, he's a businessman. They're all against him. Kind of roll the dice and see whether he can make things better. And those guys, they aren't deluded. They aren't cheerleaders. They're not actually attracted by his fear language. You know, the wall keeping out migrants goes down really well in affluent older America. But for working class guys in Texas or Georgia, they're not bothered about that. What they want, though, is somebody who says, I'll make things better. And they believe is on their side. How can a Northeast billionaire with a silver spoon in his mouth, have persuaded rednecks in Georgia and Texas, he's backing them? But he has, and he still is getting their support. And that is something which you just have to take on board.
In Florida, for this series, you got upset as you listened to a mum recall how her daughter was shot in the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. Let's just have a listen to this.
I got a strange number, and I answered it. And I could hear my daughter's cry. We started texting the number, and then we get responses, the text.
What did the text say?
There's been a shooting. I said, where? At school. Samantha's been shot. It's not what you expect when you send your kids to school. You expect them to come back home. And I was blessed that she did. But some did not.
It's just really hard to listen to. It's just your absolute worst nightmare to get that call and for it to be your kids. And as a parent, you're there to protect them. And at that moment, she didn't know what was going on and what to do. That's just the hardest thing.
Well, you were clearly deeply upset by that, Ed. We can hear that.
I was, and it forgets me now. And I wasn't expecting it to happen in the way it did, because the second episode is all about guns and gun crime in America. And you know, basically Southern Americans' love of guns. But of course, Parkland, this terrible shooting where 17 students died, had happened just as we were going out to America. So we arranged to go there at the end and see whether or not Donald Trump was going to listen to the students saying they wanted gun control. And I'd arranged to meet an 18-year-old student who was in the classroom. She was shot in the eye and in both legs. And I was expecting the conversation with her to be, you know, really tough and difficult. But she was so head screwed on. She sort of said, this is ridiculous. You know, something's got to be done. She was so kind of balanced about the need for change. But then I asked her mum what happened on that day. And suddenly there's a mum explaining the helplessness of getting a text and not knowing what's going on, other than the fact that your daughter had been shot. And I think suddenly for me, I wasn't expecting this. It was the mum's helplessness which kind of hit me really hard, because know, we've got three kids. They go to school every day. They have done, you know, since they were 4 years old, and you always assume they're going to come home safely. And suddenly when you're confronted with a mum, because of, you know, an 18-year-old who was able to go into a shop and buy a semi-automatic weapon and then shoot his fellow students. I mean, so yeah, it was, look, I came out after a three-hour conversation with them thinking that, you know, I was through that and I'd kept very calm and done a good interview. And the director said to me with the camera, how was that? And I started to speak and suddenly all came flowing out, all of that kind of deep upset that I felt on behalf of the mum, because I could just imagine what it must be like to be a parent. The point where she says, I was the lucky one, but others weren't lucky because their children didn't come home.
And with that happening on just too much of a regular basis, you know, gun tragedy in America, can you get your head around why there is such a vociferous gun lobby?
Well, I think the answer really has to be no to that, even though, you know, I understand the history of America, you know, the West, you know, people's independence from the federal government, all of those things, you know, the fact that down in Texas and in the South, you know, local law enforcement happened in a pretty Wild West way 100 years ago, and that still carries on. The nature of the program is I don't go in with a really strong opinion. I'm going to listen, but every now and then, you know, I come out of a meeting and just have to say to the camera, you know, these guys are just crazy. And I did a radio program, a phone-in, about gun controls, where they were saying, you know, more guns means less crime, arm the teachers. If anybody, including the government, the Congress, tried to take our guns away, we would rise up in an armed way to oppose them. They were accusing the students at Parkland of being crisis actors and making it up. And I walked out of that interview and said to the camera, this is just totally bonkers. It's out of control. But the interesting thing about the students was that they were so careful and rational and considered in making the argument, not for getting rid of guns entirely, that's not going to happen in America, but for age restrictions on, you know, those extreme semi-automatic and automatic weapons. Donald Trump, while we were there, did a television press conference in which he said, the time for gun control is now. So I thought to myself, my gosh, this is going to change. Maybe there's some optimism. What we now know is in the weeks after our visit and that Parkland shooting, there was another mass shooting in a school in Texas, and Donald Trump went to the National Rifle Association, the lobby group conference, and told them, while I'm the president, you will never have restrictions on your ownership of guns. And so it feels like however many times you have these tragedies in America and however much the immediate reaction, things go back to the status quo, and it's a bad status quo.
Let me ask you more about Donald Trump, because you in your past life as a politician have had the media being hostile. You've had the media being aggressive. That's part of what the media should be, by the way, when it's appropriate, aggressive. And what Donald Trump's tactics is to ridicule the integrity then of the media, of journalism, and this line that journalists are the enemies of the people.
Yep.
What's your reaction to that? What are your thoughts around that?
My reaction is that politics gets into a very dangerous place when you demonise the opposition and demonise the press. And there was a thing in Britain last night on Twitter with people from the left saying boycott the BBC because the BBC are not independent, not straight, don't give a fair deal. Look, we have in the BBC a highly regulated, independent objective broadcaster. I think the same is true for the other TV channels as well.
Listen,
our journalism, for our country, for our democracy.
Let me just provide you with some context. It's not just Trump that does it. It's happened to this programme, the Nolan Show.
Yeah.
The biggest party in Northern Ireland, the DUP, has boycotted this programme and do not allow any of their MLAs or MPs to come onto this programme. And sources within the DUP, multiple sources have told me, it's because they did not like the coverage that I did of the RHI inquiry. That boycott has now gone on for over a year. So it's not just Trump doing it.
I think that politicians, good politicians, sensible, sane, centre-left, centre-right politicians have got a duty to lead and be responsible. And if you have a broadcaster who's regulated and objective, the thing to do is go on the programme and have the discussion and have the argument. And of course there's a responsibility on you and the broadcasters to do things in a fair way, but that is something which is seen and monitored all the time. But in the end, if you say the media, a channel, a programme is the enemy of the people, if you say about your opponent, not I'll beat them in the ballot box, but lock her up. I went to a demonstration in Palm Beach against Donald Trump, and the anti-Trump people were all yelling, lock him up, lock him up. You end up in a democracy where either side wants to lock the other up, where the press is the enemy. How in the end do you get change? You don't get change through proper democratic debate. It's very, very dangerous indeed.
Well, maybe
so
what you do...
really worries me.
Well, maybe what you do is you manage to convince the public...
Yep.
That the media is corrupt, that the media does tell lies, and therefore they believe you and not the journalists and not the media.
But that is...
That's what Trump's trying to do with CNN.
But that is the road to a very dark and dangerous politics, and it's really important to call that out for what it is at every opportunity. And I think that the mainstream media in the United States has been right to call out the unwillingness of his press secretary to say the press aren't the enemy of the people. They play a hugely important role in a democracy. And the idea that if somebody doesn't say what you want or agree with what you say, therefore they are an enemy and should be silenced, that is Orwellian, 1984. There's darker places you could take that conversation. So I think what we try to show in this program is if you listen to people who disagree with you, you can find out they're reasonable, but that if you understand them, that's when you start to be able to persuade. And if you don't do that, then in the end, what do you end up with? You end up with populist outsiders who say everybody who's against me should be silenced, and you end up with people peddling extreme, dangerous solutions, which will make things worse, not better.
You might not make a bad TV presenter, because you know how to make a programme talked about. You were shot with a taser for this show. Let's have a listen to this.
How many times have you had a taser?
Just once.
In the police academy?
Yes. 5-second ride is what they call it.
The policy is you have to have one.
You have to have one. If a defense attorney takes you on the stand and says, do you know what you put my client through? Do you know what kind of pain you put him through? We can say, yes, we have.
You all right?
Yeah. As an honorary rookie, I'd agreed to have a go, but now I'm having second thoughts.
Can we just get mine done quick and then come back to you?
He's
I just
ready
kind
to
of just get it done.
Yeah.
I don't care. Whatever you're gonna do, darts is fine. Just do what you're gonna do and let's get it done.
Spotter's ready.
What did it feel like?
Goodness, I can feel it all over again just listening to that. It is the most painful thing. Two darts and pierce your skin, my back and then my butt. But it's like a massive electric shock between the two, which is totally debilitating and the most painful thing I'd ever experienced. And when it ends, it's such a relief, but it seems to go on for quite a long time. Of course, in America, the alternative to shooting somebody with a gun, this is better. But the reason why the rookies have to have that experience is so that they can explain to a court they knew what they were doing. And the reason I did it, I mean, you know, of course it's great that people watch it and laugh and enjoy it. But after that, we then all went down to a bar to talk about Trump. And I figure that, you know, all of us now members of the 5-Second Club, a bit like the prisoners in jail where I do a night in jail, if you are willing to throw yourself in and be with them and go through what they've gone through, then people are more open and honest about what they're really thinking and feeling.
I've just got a couple more minutes left with you. It's been nice talking to you today. Boris Johnson and his comments about the Muslim community, that women who wear burqas, He referred to looking like letterboxes or bank robbers. What are your thoughts?
Well, a majority of women in the Muslim community don't wear the burqa. Personally, you know, I don't like the burqa very much because I sort of think it says something kind of bad about people's attitude to women, that they should sort of be depersonalized and in that way. However, it's a religious freedom. People, for religious reasons, wear the burqa, and of course they should be allowed to wear one in our country in the same way as a Christian can wear a cross or a Sikh can wear a turban.
But equally, should Boris be allowed to use the language he did?
The reason why Boris used that language was not because he was, you know, from the Muslim community wanting a serious debate about the burqa, because there is a debate in the Muslim community about whether it's a good or bad idea. I'm afraid he did it in his Daily Telegraph column because from outside the cabinet, he wanted to, what they call in politics, send out a dog whistle. I think he wanted to sort of, you know, to equate or to compare a woman wearing a burqa to a criminal is pretty distasteful. And I think his motives are not good motives.
Do you think he should apologise?
Of course he should apologise. The Prime Minister of the country has said he should apologise, and so has the Chairman of the Conservative Party. And so, you know, I'll bow to their greater authority than mine. Of course he should apologise. But
should your party apologise for the anti-Semitism that Corbyn hasn't got a hold of, a grip of?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn tried to do a video last weekend in which he tried to express regret. But I think until the Labour Party, the leadership of the National Executive Committee shows they've really addressed the problem here, which means adopting the international definition of anti-Semitism and really rooting out anti-Semitism.
It's taken them a while to get round to it, Ed.
I know, and it's hugely frustrating. As I was saying to you earlier, Lord Eric Pickles and I are co-chairs of the UK Holocaust Foundation. It's our job, appointed by the Prime Minister, to build a national memorial to the Holocaust next to our Parliament in London, because back in the 1930s, the most terrible event of the 20th century happened because a parliament in Germany allowed it to happen, and parliaments in other parts of the world, including Britain, didn't do enough to address the threat. So our warning to our parliament is learn these lessons and make sure it never happens again. So we need our parliamentarians to be absolutely with all of us in saying the Holocaust was the greatest evil, and we should never tolerate and root out at any opportunity anti-Semitism in our country. And I think Jeremy Corbyn needs to take more of a lead than he's done so far.
And final question, is politics definitely over for you, or might you go back in the future?
I think it's always better in life to move forward and to make sure you're always doing the next thing for, you know, the right reason. And I had a conversation with Michael Portillo last year, after he lost his seat, he went back into Parliament as a Member of Parliament, and he said it was a mistake because he was trying to set the record straight, and I've not wanted to do that. So it's good to be doing new things, and it's really good to, you know, in the Trump programme, clearly it's about politics, but it's not UK party politics. I'm not going to say to you I would never go back. Of course I miss being a cabinet minister. I'm not going to say I never would, but it's not part of my plan, and it's not something I'm working towards. And I don't think I will. I don't expect to. And I'm enjoying doing these new things, and that's great.
And we look forward to seeing it on BBC Two. It's 9 o'clock this Sunday, right? Okay.
And you can watch the first two episodes on iPlayer. And actually, they're all different. And you didn't talk about the wrestling. If you want to see me in a wrestling leotard,
I can't think of anything worse.
I can't believe that.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, Steve.
Mr. Balls, thank you.